Our next presenter is going to be Mike Liljegren, who works with Minnesota DNR. And Mike's going to be talking to us today about borehole mining of manganese near Emily, Minnesota.
Thanks, Steve. I see Ernie left. I was going to ask him. I didn't get a chance to see him before he left. It sounded like this morning was a prerequisite to work for Ernie before you got to speak here today. So maybe there'll be a chance with his up-and-coming projects to work with him on those projects. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about borehole mining of manganese near Emily, or could have been called MN in MN. Talk today will cover a little bit of the geology of the manganese deposit near Emily. Some of the proposed mining methods that were looked at other than the borehole technique, and then discuss a little bit about the bulk sample collection project permitting requirements that will go into that, and the hydrogeologic evaluation that was done for the EAW. So in overview, ultimately they're going to collect a bulk sample at the site, approximately 12,000 cubic yards of manganese-rich iron formation from one borehole. I'll talk about evaluation of the borehole mining technology. It's using a high-pressure water jet to mine in situ, and ore water slurry is pumped out, filtered, and re-injected. So filtered material will be trucked to the University of Minnesota Minerals Research Facility in Coleraine for processing. And EAW was developed for the collection of this bulk sample. Ultimately, if the project moves forward beyond that after the bulk sample, EIS would be required if they go to a full-scale operation. So who's proposing the project? It's Cooperative Mineral Resources. They're a wholly owned subsidiary of Crow Wing Power. Ultimately, profit shared with their 36,000 members, and most of them are in Crow Wing County. So environmental permitting and the hydrologic evaluations were done by Bar Engineering, and the bulk sample collection stays on schedule. They're hoping to start the bulk sample collection in August of this year. So a little bit about the geology. Here's a photo of the borehole mining site. I know a lot of our discussion this morning was on the Mesabi Range, near the Mesabi Range. This project we're going back is in the on the Cuyuna Range, or the old Iron Range. Can see here Crow Wing County. It's in the northern portion of Crow Wing County, northeast of Brainerd, Crosby, Ironton, in the just north of Emily. And iron mining took place on the Cuyuna Range from 1904 to 1984, about 106 million tons of ore mined. So the Cuyuna Range is divided into three districts: the Emily District here, and the North Range, and the South Range. The Emily District, its formation is a thin band on the limb of a north-plunging anticline. You can see here is Emily. It's just north of Emily, and you have Outing to the north. And the dot right here is the proposed project site. Here you have the iron formation in the Emily District with the Pokagama Quartz site, Virginia formation. So the Emily District formation are broken into three units, A, B, and C, and they do correlate with the Boabic iron formation of the Mesabi Iron Range, although there are layers of slate in between those, but otherwise they are a correlation to the Boabic iron formation on the Mesabi Range. So a little bit about the depositional history. Similar to the Boabic iron formation, the chemical precipitation of iron and silica in a shallow Precambrian sea, with the abundance of oolitic hematite, indicated wave action reworking. Manganese enrichment is in the two zones, corresponding to oolitic zones. You have the upper enriched zone and the lower enriched zone. Little bit on the mineralogy of the deposit. The primary ore minerals, manganite, and the magnesium manganese concentration is by weight greater than 50% in the two zones, which it corresponds to a high-grade ore. hematite is the dominant iron mineral with almost zero sulfur. What is the manganese used for? Essential to iron and steel production by virtue of its sulfur fixing. And it's and there is no substitute for that. And an alloying agent in aluminum, especially in beer cans. used for new generation batteries, pollutant removal from coal-fired power plant emissions. Getting into a little bit of the world source of manganese. High grade is considered greater than 44% manganese, and there's approximately 680 million tons of ore worldwide, mostly in the southern hemisphere. And there's limited export of that manganese. Low grade then we have is less than 44 percent. Russia has some low grade ore deposits, but they are depleting. And China has some as well, but they're mainly using it for their own use. And there are some thin layers on the ocean floor that have not been mined yet. So a little bit about how much manganese is available at the Emily site. The Bureau of Mines has it estimated as around 2 billion pounds or a million tons in a 9-acre area within the two zones, 50 feet thick by 70 feet. The deepest of these zones is approximately 400 feet, likely is the largest high-grade manganese deposit in the northern hemisphere. The iron formation, the sections of the iron formation are very friable, and this is important to determine whether or not this can be mined in an environmentally friendly manner. So that's ultimately when I get to talking about borehole mining, because it's so friable, that's why they've looked at this and believe they can, Cooperative Mineral Resource can make this work with borehole in situ mining. The bedrock is overlain with approximately 200 feet of sand and gravel. You can see in here the iron formation, sand and gravel at the surface, approximately 200 feet thick. This cross section is, you have Emily down here, here's the site, Ruth Lake, Anna Lake. The cross section is right through here. Depth to water at the site's approximately 35 feet. And again, the soils here are very sandy at the surface. Just going back again, here is the proposed site. Ruth Lake again, Anna Lake, Blue Lake, with the regional groundwater flow from northeast to southwest. A little bit about the borehole mining process. Ultimately, what it is, you have drill down a borehole, and you have an outside pipe, and then you also have a pipe that's on the inside, and on the outside one here that you can see in blue, up here where it says swivel, goes down, and that's where they'll be injecting water in at about 1,800 psi. And ultimately, that goes down the outside, and you can see it where it comes out here. And ultimately, what it does is blasts and gets back to what I was talking about with it being so friable, that when you blast that with water, you get a slurry that's formed, and ultimately, that slurry then falls to the bottom of the borehole and then is pumped back up through the center and back out, and then it's run through, and I'll get to that, it's run through some screens and filters and what it was looked at the site, they had looked at potentials for some different types of mining approaches. One was open pit mining. The problem there they'd have to deal with is you have 200 feet of saturated overburden, and dewatering would be a fair amount of water. And underground mining, likely extensive dewatering and very expensive. Plus, we're setting with all that sand and gravel on the. They're setting with all the sand and gravel on the top, so they don't really have a competent basement rock to hold it. So, and in situ leach mining, it was studied by the Bureau of Mines and ultimately deemed practical, but probably not environmentally accepted. So, borehole mining is performed hydraulically, and I discussed on it a little bit, but it's a little bit better picture. Again, the high pressure water on the outside to the formation, and ultimately a slurry is formed and pumped back up to the surface. And they start at the bottom and work their way up. You'll see in these schematics here, start at the bottom and slowly just keep moving it up, because they can only get out, at least with what they've looked at, one borehole out 50 feet is at least what I've been told as of recently. So ultimately, if they were to go into further mining, there would ultimately be more than one borehole at this site. But this, for the EAW and the bulk sample, there'll just be one of these boreholes pulling out that 12,000 cubic yard sample. So ultimately, what it does is you just start, and the tool head at the top just rotates 360 degrees until you've reached the lateral extent that you can't get anymore, and then that's ultimately where you'd have to have another borehole so far away that would then ultimately meet those two to collect all the, just a quick schematic showing, like I was saying, you start at the bottom, you just keep working up until you've reached your capacity that you can no longer, and ultimately a second borehole would have to go in next door. So as it comes out of the pumping through the center, ultimately comes back to the surface and is run through some screens, a thickener, and filtration. And the majority of the water is taken out. You have 790 GPM coming in, plus 118 GPM of the solids. Ultimately, what you have for clear water that comes back out and is re-injected is 750. So you have about 40 GPM that's lost that goes off off-site with the process. Again, net instantaneous withdrawal of 40 GPM. They're looking at running the operation for the bulk sample on 8 hours a day at 5 days a week. So the total estimated withdrawal during the collection of the bulk sample is about 1.15 million gallons. And their estimated operation days are 45. So I'll talk a little bit about evaluations that were looked at for permitting of this bulk sample. Some of the required permits and environmental review. Again, as I stated in the beginning, an environmental worksheet was done for the bulk sample. DNR was the RGU on that. And ultimately, like I said in the beginning, it's an EAW for the bulk sample. Ultimately, if they end up going forward in a full-scale operation, it would go to a mandatory EIS. Water appropriation permit needed from the DNR, operation and reclamation plan from the DNR, state disposal system permit for stormwater by PCA, conditional use permit from the City of Emily, and an underground injection control permit from EPA. A little bit of the aquifer testing and modeling that was done at the site. An 18-inch borehole was drilled with an 8-inch temporary casing that was installed in that borehole for the aquifer test that was done. Here's the site, the late Ruth and Ann Lake here. Here's a closer picture with the pumping well and the monitoring wells that were put in. There was five monitoring wells. This is a shallow one. These two sites here were nested with one in the formation and one in the sand and gravel, as shown here. Before the EAW and the aquifer test study was done, the company along with Barr were measuring lake stages and pan evaporation. You can see here on all the lakes in and around the area, you can see the ones in blue that were all monitored before and during the aquifer test, and ultimately will be monitored after as well, because all that data then will ultimately be, if they decide to move forward, could be used in the EIS process and ultimate permitting for the full-scale operation. Water chemistry in both of the units are fairly similar. Dissolved iron is typically higher in the sand and gravel aquifer. Dissolved manganese is typically higher in the sand and gravel aquifer. Major ions with similar concentrations in both units. Trace metals were non-detect for most of them. pH from 6.5 to 7, and EH of minus 140. So examples, one of the lakes, Blue Lake, that was looked at, you can see during the box during the period of pumping, but ultimately there was a downward trend at that point in time regionally on all of the lakes in the area. So ultimately the aquifer test was run for just over 162 hours of continuous pumping at plus or minus 200, tried to keep it as close to 200 as possible. Ultimately, 1.95 million gallons of water were pumped during the aquifer test. And if you recall, in previous slides, I commented that with the 40 GPM, it'd be about 1.15. So the amount that was here was to stress the aquifer to make sure that the results we seen would be similar or greater than what was actually being done for the bulk sample. They had some interesting results at the site when they were pumping the borehole. You can see here when they started, they had drawdowns, and then all of a sudden, it cut off. After so many minutes into the test, hydraulic connectivity changed, and their drawdown was at just over 100. So, in a result, they had a huge improvement in well efficiency. The friableness of the formation, it caved in and ultimately made the well more efficient, which was fairly interesting. Some of the maximum drawdowns in the sand and gravel aquifer ultimately was less than 5 feet. You can see here the bottom three, the light blue, purplish color, brown, are the sand and gravel aquifers, and here is drawdown in feet. Here's a half a foot. So everything in the sand and gravel aquifers that they had had a drawdown of less than a half a foot. In the iron formation, the two monitoring wells, one was around a foot and the other one was between 2.5 and 3 feet. Water level recovery in the ob wells were fairly rapid. You can see here right around 10, 11, 12 hours, we're starting to flatten back out again with almost full recovery. So ultimately, the wells were analyzed for aquifer parameters using some conventional analytic methods. Octisolve was used on these. And ultimately, Barr produced a two-layer mod flow model that was developed and calibrated to the aquifer test data that they ran on site. And here is the borehole demonstration project right here in the middle of the where the Titan grid cells are. So ultimately, the model was calibrated to honor the analytical solution results. So you can see in here the parameter types, the model calibration values versus the Newman-Witherspoon values. And the model seemed to do a fairly good job. They were with at least within the range of values. predicted maximum drawdown during the bulk sample collection. Here again on the left is a sand and gravel aquifer with a pumping site. We're not out too far. You can see here we have 0.02 foot drawdown out to this outer circle. And in here in the iron formation, again the pump well, you're seeing a 0.1 foot of drawdown predicted out to this outer circle here. Model predicted changes in lake stages. Again, on the left axis here, this is changes in lake elevation in inches, not feet, in inches. Here you can see the maximum one is Anna at just shy of 0.06 inch drawdown. And let's see if we go back. It's not even, if you see on the outer circle here, 0.02, but it's not even, and you can't even see the lake. The reason for the biggest reason for the drawdown in the lake is the water that will ultimately be captured and not would normally make it to the lake will be captured here. Another big issue that they dealt with was subsidence. That was one of the big issues in the EAW as to seeing you have all the sand and gravel on the top with no major competent rock below. So ultimately they used a model program FLAC was used for model used for geotechnical parameters from the core tests that they had. So ultimately, subsidence will be modeled during the bulk sample and after, but from the data that was used and went into the model, they're looking at a maximum subsidence at the surface of 10 feet right next to the bore, and then it extends radius from the borehole just less than 50 feet. So ultimately, you have the bulk sample where you're going to be taking out the sample and leaving a cavern in the bulk sample. Ultimately, you get a cone, which will ultimately, there will be some subsidence here. So ultimately, there'll be monitoring that goes on. Extensiometers will be placed to monitor that subsidence. Because ultimately, if they decide to go to a full scale, you know, here this is only a bulk sample. You know, ultimately they would have four or five boreholes, and this would be one big cavern. So depending upon whether you put material back in there or monitor that subsidence and do something at the surface will be something they'll have to look at. So what's next? The bulk sample, I said, is planned for August if everything goes as planned by the company. Continuous monitoring will ultimately occur during the sample process and after that because all of this data will ultimately be helpful in the EIS if they go forward in a full-scale mining operation. And the full-scale mining will likely be probably more than one, but up to four or five simultaneous boreholes in operation at any one time. So I just want to thank Ray Wulo. I guess he wasn't, he's not here today, but a lot of the information, seeing Barr did a lot of the hydrogeologic work on this. A lot of the stuff in the slides were information from Ray, and then also James Agri from Crow Wing Power was nice enough to allow myself to present their project on behalf of those guys today. So with that, I'll take any questions. From what I know and understand of what their operation, they're looking at lateral extent in the borehole with the 1,800 PSI. They can get out to 50 to 60 feet. Ultimately they may have. It won't be that much. It's on, like I said, it's on a 9-acre site. They'll have possibly. Scattered throughout that, if we can get back to them, scattered throughout that site, they'll have only four boreholes total on that. So here they have the first one, which will ultimately be used if they go forward. They'll use this one as well, and then you remember where the formation went through. You know, they may have one or two on each side. With that lateral distance to pick up.
Half a mile, maybe.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, that's at least as far as I know so far, yep. Yeah, as far as I know, they haven't we haven't fully discussed that, but that's one option that is being looked at, whether or not they would fill it back with sand and not use cement, they'd use sand. Right now, from what I know, that's what I thought you were asking. Right now, they're looking at, from what I've been told, they can recover out with that 1,800 PSI. They're saying, at least in other places, they're good 50, 60 feet in a radius of that borehole. So. That I don't know. Yeah. Pardon me?
Do you know what prompted Crow Wing Power to leave for
Megan? You know, I don't. Nope. Randy? From what I understand, yes, I don't know a lot about it. But it sounds like it has been used in other places. I don't know, are you on Crow Wing Power? They're in direct connection with the sand and gravel operation, yes. Or the sand and gravel operation with the sand and gravels.
But